You're listening to Slow Theology, Simple Faith for Chaotic Times, with AJ Swoboda and EJ Gupta.
Friends, welcome back to Slow Theology, where we are seeking as best as we can to equip followers of Jesus with a way of doing theology that is intentional, it is thoughtful, it's not reactive, it is, you know, it's slow. We're doing slow. That's what we're doing, slow theology. And yeah. Today's episode is long awaited. I've been really kind of biting my tongue for months on this one, wanting to have this conversation with my co-conspirator, Dr. Nijay Gupta, about his recently published book, Strange Religion, How the First Christians Were Weird, Dangerous, and Compelling. I have recently been lecturing to my Old Testament class about the book of Daniel, and we spend a whole session in the book of Daniel. We spend a whole session looking at Daniel chapter 1. Daniel's in exile. He is in this distant land with his three friends, and as Daniel enters this exilic experience in a foreign land, there's two sides to his engagement with that culture. On one hand, Daniel is a willing participant in Babylonian culture. He takes on a job as a Babylonian. He literally works for Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, he takes on a role in the Babylonian Empire. And yet, when he is invited to eat from the king's table, he rejects, largely out of commitment to kosher laws and the sort, he rejects eating the king's food. And it does the Daniel fast. He eats vegetables and drinks water alone and is healthier than all the others. This story is about how people who love God look weird. That's the whole, really the whole narrative of Daniel 1 is being an exile, being a person in a foreign land makes you look like a weirdo. You have written a whole book about this, and specifically, Nijay, about how the earliest Christians in their context, first century, Greco-Roman context, first, second, third century, that earliest season of time, they would have just looked so out of place to their world. So I want to ask you two questions here. Well, one question is personal. We're going to talk about the personal side, and then the content of the book. So I've just noticed, Nijay, that increasingly you are writing in such a way that you want to take the best academic stuff and make it accessible to real people on the ground. Can you tell me why that is? What happened in your life? Why has writing for the church, really good academic work, why has that become so important to you?
Thanks for the question. You know, we both have talked about how we are kind of odd ducks in the academic world because, you know, I don't dream about presenting at the big academic conferences, and I don't particularly have a lot of fun there except, you know, having a meal with a good friend, that sort of thing. I kind of feel out of place there in many ways because I don't aspire to publish, you know, a $200 monograph on a really niche topic that'll be read by, you know, 20 of my peers. I benefit from those kinds of books. I'm glad that there are scholars out there that do that kind of writing. But, you know, from the time I actually decided to go the academic route, I knew that I wanted to be ecclesially oriented. I didn't go to a Bible college or a Christian college. I went to a secular college. So I don't have that Bible. I don't have that Christian college background. And then my first experience in Christian higher ed is in the seminary. Mm. I just fell in love with that environment of just keeping our eyes on the formation of the church and the engagement of the gospel towards the world. I think the way my brain works, AJ, I'm always thinking about how what I'm researching about just relates to the grocery store and the dinner table and what's going on in our kids' school, all of that stuff. Like I don't have these silos where I say, okay, I'm going to get away from the world and I'm just going to get cloistered into my office and I'm just going to, you know, sort of hide or live in this, you know, ancient realm or something like that where other biblical scholars sometimes do. I think that's fine if that's the way your brain works. Mine just doesn't. So I think it's just where my heart is. I resonated last time we talked about your career with your idea that you love taking academic ideas, but then how can this shape and form the church? How can this shape and form human lives? I think I'm right there with you. I think the challenge is publishers don't often know what to do.
You're a weirdo. That's right.
You know, for those that don't know, like there are two common terms. There are academic and there's trade. So trade is like the New York Times bestseller stuff, the things that, you know, quote unquote, popular level. And then there's academic books that are, you know, more expensive, more, they don't try to be real savvy. They're just trying to relay really, you know, cutting edge information, or sometimes not even cutting edge information. And I think you and I, AJ, we exist in this weird in between. Yep. I think you called yourself a low level theologian.
Yep.
I've used the language lobby level.
Love it.
And I think that's just because I love regular life, and I also love the academic life of the mind, and I just want to bring them together. And I've just noticed that there's a certain group of people that this really resonates with. Yep. And I think that's kind of my audience. I think of pastors, and I know you do too, who are just really busy and they can't sit down and read a Tom Wright 1600 page Paul and the Faithfulness of God, or maybe they don't have the academic skills and tools to read, you know, a 500 or 600 page John Barclay book, or a Richard Bauckham book, or Larry Hurtado, or Beverly Gaventa. And if I can serve that purpose of simplifying, condensing, applying all of that, I love that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Nijé, you and I both are, you know, academics in academic settings.
Yeah.
And while our hearts, minds really are oriented towards serving the church, we do live in the academic realm. And I think in many respects, the way that like seminary life and kind of Christian academy is shifting right now. And a lot of institutions are changing, and many of them are shrinking. And I think, would you agree with the statement that in the next 20, 30, 40 years, we're going to really need to embrace what it looks like to return deep biblical study and theological work to the local church? Like, it's going to need to increasingly be that these are not two worlds, but they are one world. Would you agree that that is the future?
I've been having a lot of these conversations the last few months about the crisis of Christian higher ed, the crisis of higher education in general, the cost, but also the philosophy, you know, who's backing this stuff. And I feel like we're going to see a major change in higher ed in the next 20 to 30 years.
Yep.
Because, you know, I look at my region and how many private institutions are struggling. But then there are also churches that are thriving, and there's energy, there's savvy, all this stuff. I think seminaries sometimes get stuck because they try to be an academic institution and a resource for the church, and they kind of like they struggle with that.
Yeah, right.
And I do think we're on the brink of a major change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Nijé, can you just, I mean, before we get to the actual book, was there a moment or an experience or something that happened that caused your heart to really turn more towards writing for the church? Like, did you see something or experience something that made that shift? Because you are a world-class scholar, but I mean, something happened. I mean, did you just see something? Was there a recognition of the need? I don't know. Can you put your finger on something?
That's a good question. You know, the weird thing is when we do our dissertations, which, you know, you try your best to be the most academic you could possibly be.
Yeah.
And I just feel like I produced a very par, if not subpar, dissertation. And it's just such a humbling experience. But, you know, I started a blog back in like 2007 or 2008. And what I noticed was, even though my academic writing felt really not resonant, the blog really
popped. Yeah.
Struck a nerve, and people are like, oh, great. I realized like short form, condensing, simplifying, almost kind of preaching level, you know, this really struck a nerve. But I'll say my first book where I just thought, okay, I might actually have a writing ministry was my Beginner's Guide to New Testament Studies. And, you know, a publisher just took a chance on me, you know, Brian Dyer, my friend. And he just said, okay, let's give this kid a shot. I kind of think of Alexander Hamilton, you know, let's give this kid a shot kind of thing. I'm not Alexander Hamilton, but, you know, it's like someone's got to believe in you. Someone's got to give you a shot. And I feel like that happened. But I'll tell you what, Tell Her Story you know, that's one of my more recent books, but I do feel like that one was like, in order for a book to succeed, people kind of think that's my first book because they never heard of me before, right? Mm. And it's almost like an actor where they've been doing it for 20 years and then you just realize when they're in, you know, like an Avengers movie or something. But, you know, with Teller's Story, it just was right book, right time, right cover, right title, you know, right moment, all that stuff. But I would say that gave me the confidence I needed to say, okay, I'm going to try to pull off another miracle in terms of, like, we spend a lot of time on these books. And the worst thing for me is it just to fall flat. Like, you spent years on this and it's like crickets. And I've had those experiences. I've had those experiences recently. That's disheartening. Yeah,
right.
But yeah, I think Teller's Story was a big turning point.
Yep. Fabulous. Well, countless are recipients of your work. Keep it up, Nijay. Let's talk about this book, Strange Religion, I had the privilege of endorsing. Can I actually read my endorsement?
Yeah.
This, and with the buttery voice, I feel like the written endorsement doesn't quite capture what I really felt. But this is my endorsement. Insightful, funny, captivating, and forceful all at once. Strange Religion reminds the church of its mission. Keep things weird. Tell me, Nijay, why were Christians in the first century so intent on looking different? Why is weirdness in the first century Greco-Roman world, why is that a virtue?
You know, it's really not. And so that makes it all the more stark. The Roman world prized conformity. You know, I think in different parts of the country, and I recently spent some time in Birmingham, Alabama, and there's a lot of cultural conformity. It's not always bad. I'm just talking about things like style and preferences and music. And whereas here in Portland, like, one of the things I love about Portland is, like, you can just dress whatever way you want. And people don't really think twice about it. And I tell you what, people take that really seriously. I mean, there is kind of the sportsy culture and you wear Nike or Adidas and all of that. But generally speaking, like, you see people with weird hair colors and wearing kind of just weird random stuff. But in the Roman world, really, really high conformity context where it only brought you benefits culturally to conform to Romanness, and it only brought you trouble to stand out from Romanness. And like you said, these Christians come along and they're just backwards and upside down. There's an early critic of Christianity in Celsus, and he says, I put this in my book at the beginning, he says, if all men had wanted to be Christians, the Christians would no longer want them. And his whole point is, these Christians are just bizarro. Like, they just march to the beat of a completely different drummer. So my question is, which is at the heart of the book, is what would compel them to dare and risk the comfort and security of conformity? I mean, who does that and why? And it's easy to deviate in a small way once in a while. You know, like, I'm going to wear pajamas to the grocery store or something. Like, that's low risk. You could do that. But to do it on such a public, prominent level, you know, I like to say to people when I'm talking about the book that, you know, the staples of Roman religion were priests, temples, sacrifices, material sacrifices, and statues. And you did these things to keep the Roman gods happy so you didn't face wrath. And here you have these Christians, they don't have any of those things. Their god is invisible. They've beaten houses early in the morning or late at night. They call each other brother and sister. They share a kiss. They don't have any sacrifices. They don't have any priests. They're just nothing like anybody else. They're like aliens. They're like aliens from another planet. They were heavily criticized in the second, third century for being so completely deviant. I think about cults today, the way we look at cults and how dangerous they are for society. Like, there's a line in culture today where we say, okay, it's okay for this cult to exist as long as they don't. But then there's a line you cross where it becomes, you know, dangerous. Let's send the FBI in, raid the place. That's kind of the Christians. They were that level of dangerous for Romans.
Interesting.
Once they realized what they were actually doing.
Interesting. So there's a level of, I mean, you it's interesting that you contrast Portland in the first century church, because in Portland, nonconformity has, now people are conforming to nonconformity.
Exactly.
So there's this kind of like, okay, to I remember that there's this great line, David Foster Wallace, in one of his, I don't remember what book it was, but he said something to the effect of, everybody is now identical in their secret unspoken belief that they're different from everybody else. This idea, like we are all dead set on not being. So there's a kind of nonconformity that's just being nonconformist for nonconformist sake. But you're saying the earliest Christians were not nonconformist to just be nonconformist.
Right.
Their worship, there was something about their worship, who they worshiped, that shaped the way that they lived. So how does one's allegiance to Jesus make you live differently in the world then? I mean, how does relate for us how worship and loving Jesus changes our relationship to the world and our relationship to our habits and the way we live our everyday lives?
Yeah, I mean, that's the heart of the book, isn't it? And, I just was speaking recently to a group of people about the book, and I talked about, you know, today we can use the word God and we can use a really generic way and, you know, God bless America or God bless the United States of America, all that stuff. And it's this really generic sort of contextless, cultureless way of referring to God. The ancient world, gods had names. God were very specific and they were competitive. You know, when Rome went to war against any nation, their gods were warring against those gods. Mm. And so I call this the ancient paradigm. So the way I explain it is a god creates a kingdom, and a kingdom establishes a culture, and a culture influences values and lifestyle. So this is just what you're saying. So when Jesus comes on the scene and he's proclaiming the kingdom of God and he's calling himself Savior and Lord and Messiah and ruler, sovereign, all that stuff, it's always going to be competitive. Right. Because you're living in a context in the Roman world or in the Jewish subculture where you have your own allegiances. And so when the Christians come along and they say, Jesus is Lord of all, it's going to be a clear antagonism towards the way of Rome. Now, I'm not saying to the degree where Rome's scared. I mean, they're a massive empire with, you know, a very good track record of success. They're not really worried. Right. About a small group of Christians, but Christians were making totalizing claims. They were saying, God's going to establish a new world order. All the powers are going to be upended. Read Mary's Song of Praise, Luke chapter 1. Read the book of Acts. You know, they're turning the world upside down. They're proclaiming another king other than Caesar. But where it really comes into play in our lifestyle is reflecting on how does our lifestyle and values reflect our culture? How does our culture reflect our kingdom, and has our kingdom reflect our deity? Because one of the areas of dissonance today is we Christians claim to follow Jesus, but our lifestyles actually seem more resonant with Rome or with some other form of paganism. And so I like to get people thinking about these wider systems of gods and kingdoms, cultures, and lifestyles. So let me give you some examples. Jesus says this stuff plainly. He says to his disciples, you look at the pagans, you look at the Gentiles, you look at the people without God, and they lord it over each other. You know, it's a limited good competitive economy where if I'm going to win, I got to punch you in the face. And Jesus says, no, we're not going to do it that way. We're going to do it the opposite. We're going to do it the other way, where we serve and love people. And that's going to be unfathomable in a Roman system where it's designed for competition, domination, classism, self-glorification, self-aggrandizement. Jesus comes in. He says, love, service, humility, things that are upside down and backwards. You know, when people read my book, they often ask me, like, Nijay, you didn't get into the so what, how do I live now? I tend to do two things when they ask me that, because I wanted to write my book really as a disoriented, I'm dropping you in the first century, in a world you don't know, to help you understand what these Christians were like in that world. But then you want to come back and figure out how to do it better. So I recommend two things for those that are listening. One is reading John Mark Comer's Practicing the Way. I feel like if you're just hungry and you're just fired up after reading Strange Religion and you're like, I want to do something different, I think a good next step is to read Practicing the Way. And that's going to start you in the right direction of how do I actually follow Jesus? The second thing I'd say is, and it's not unpredictable coming from a Bible scholar here, sit down and commit yourself to a study of the Sermon on the Mount. if we really, AJ, if we really took the Sermon on the Mount seriously, we wouldn't actually have to ask the question, how should we live as Christians? Mm-hmm. It's written there. We just don't always want to do it. It's all written there. It's the Christian lifestyle is clear, I think. But it's so hard. I think we try to find other ways of saying, okay, but how else could I do?
Yeah.
How else could I do it? Because this seems really hard. Like, love your enemies. You know, that's too hard. But is there another thing I could do to make Jesus happy?
Yeah. I mean, tell me a little bit. I mean, actually put us into, if you could, like, yeah. take us just for a few moments back to, say, the first generation of Christians after the ascension of Jesus. And let's just imagine for a second, EJ, if we could do this, let's imagine that there is a pagan Roman. Okay. Yeah. So a Roman who does not worship Jesus, is not a part of the church. And they get to follow around a first century Christian for one whole day. They just get to walk around. Okay. What tangibly in the day of a Christian, what tangibly would a Roman who's following a Christian around say to themselves, that is the weirdest thing in the world? Like, what are they actually seeing in the way that they structure their life that would make a Roman do like a double take? Like, that's just the weirdest thing. What would they see?
Yeah. Let me give you some examples. We do have really helpful case studies in the Bible, but let me give you an example. So something that's really popular in the ancient world were competitive dinner parties. So, you know, if you had a big dinner party, which was really common for elites, it wasn't just to have friends over. What you're trying to do was show off your status, and you wanted to invite both people that were more important so you could cozy up to them, people at your level so you could make them jealous, and then people at the lower level so you could show that you were superior to them. So you have these dinner parties. We learn about this in many places, but one of my favorite is the ancient satire writer Juvenal. So so Juvenal, not a Christian, he narrates a kind of low, you know, a bottom dweller going to one of these dinner parties for the first time. And the idea is you go to one of these parties, and if you're a bottom dweller and you've been invited really to be humiliated, you're going to be seated far away from the action. So far away, sometimes they were seated in the toilet, the latrine. You're going to get cold food. You're going to get moldy food. You're going to get rock hard bread. You're going to, you know, not get a chance to talk to anybody important or special, that sort of thing. This was all part of this competitive, you know, all this stuff. So let's say you followed a Christian there. What would they do differently? I think one of the obvious things, if you read James chapter 2 or you read Jesus's parable, the Great Banquet, is they're not going to look at people through the eyes of status. If they're a good Christian, they're going to look at people through the eyes of Jesus. There's a certain confidence, maybe even a swagger that says, I don't need to play these games. I don't need to play these games. So you're going to show up and you're going to like open the latrine and talk to somebody.
Wow. You know what
I mean? Like, you're going to be like, hey, you want to go out and get, you know, go to a pub somewhere and chat it up and, you know, that sort of thing. Like, I would say another thing is just a lack of fear. Like, there's going to be idols everywhere. There's going to be cult statues everywhere. And people are going to be afraid to make sure they don't get the wrong side of these gods. And if you got a confident Christian like a St. Paul out there, they're going to just walk right by these idols. They don't have a care in the world. I think of Polycarp. You probably know the legend of Polycarp. But Polycarp, early Christian, he's being arrested, taken to the emperor. And he's in some kind of arena, maybe the Colosseum, I don't remember. And he's about to be killed. And he has one last chance to recant. This kind of shows you that ballsiness. And I don't know if you remember the story, but you know, the emperor says he's supposed to swear to the spirit of the emperor. That's called the genius of the emperor. And then the emperor says, I will spare you if you say to the Christians, and there's other Christians there gathered to be executed. If you say to the Christians, away with the atheists, away with the godless. And Polycarp turns to the Roman crowds. He says, away with the godless. And they're like, light him up, light him up. I think there would be this confidence. And it's not this like, I'm great, you're not. It's like this, I'm not afraid. I've lived my whole life afraid, you know, your normal Roman, of being shamed, of the gods cursing me, of, you know, dying without honor, all this stuff. I'm afraid for my family. And these Christians in their best moments walk around with swagger. And they're just like, I'm not afraid. Like, you know, there's this famous tombstone, common tombstone saying, I might have mentioned this on the podcast before, from the Roman world that says, and it kind of rhymes in Latin, says, I was not, then I was, I am not now, and I care not. Mm. And it's this sort of like hopelessness. Yeah. And it's this sort of
nihilism.
Like,
yeah.
I just come through and I leave. And these Christians have this like, we know what's going to happen. We know the end of the story. So I think you follow around a Christian like Paul or Titus or, you know, Phoebe, they're going to have a clear sense of God's calling. I love that from like Galatians. Know the calling of the grace of Christ. I love that. They're going to walk around with this confidence. God has really given me really clear vision.
Yeah.
Maybe not precise, but a really clear vision of how to live in this world. And I don't have to worry so much about what everybody thinks and all this stuff. I'm just going to follow that vision.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Nietzsche, whenever somebody writes a book, this is a common experience, is that you kind of, in the process of writing, you've got some ideas of what you want to write, but then by the time you're done, you're really surprised by what you learned as a writer.
Oh, man.
What is one thing in the process of writing this book that you actually were surprised by?
Oh, my gosh. That I was really surprised by. I would say there are these Easter eggs in scripture that you don't really notice until you realize how countercultural they are. So one of them being one of my favorite lines from the New Testament, which is repeated in different ways in a variety of authors, is God is no respecter of persons. And we might translate that, God doesn't care about status. That is the most un-Roman thing in the entire Bible, and it's repeated multiple times. And I tell this story, and this brings out this contrast. I tell the story in the book. There's a famous ancient writer named Pliny. He's writing to a governor who's just kind of come into his own. He warns the governor, make sure you reinforce the class system and don't cozy up to your inferiors. And he has this famous line where he says, the most unequal thing is the appearance of equality where it doesn't exist. And that is extremely Roman. And the Christians were super defiant of that. I mean, everything that Jesus teaches, everything that's taught by the apostles, the book of Acts, is just like the big middle finger to that. I mean, that kind of thing just blows me away that, you know, here Rome's putting up all these signs about class and domination and power, and the Christians almost create signs just to oppose that. They aren't going out against the emperor. They aren't writing their senators or picketing. But this idea of just like, no thanks.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Christians are just kind of like, no thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah. Nietzsche, it's a fabulous book. And I appreciated your sort of recommendation of options, something somebody could do after reading this, reading a great book, John Mark Comer's Practicing the Way, or reading the Sermon on the Mount. But today, Nietzsche, for a church that can often, too often, look like the world that it is in, should we be weird today? Is that our call? Would Jesus say, be weird today?
Yeah, I get this question a lot because sometimes Christians can be bad weird.
Right, right.
And we don't want that. But I keep going back to John Lewis's phrase, good trouble. Mm. And I don't want to be appropriating it in a wrongful way. But I looked him up and John Lewis went to seminary. So I think, you know, if he could hear me now, he would appreciate where I'm going with this. Christians were willing to get into good trouble. And not by being jerks, not by, you know, being pain in the butts, but by just saying, we're going to go all the way with Jesus and whatever consequences there are. I think of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's famous Cost of Discipleship. And I don't know if listeners know this, but the original title wasn't The Cost of Discipleship. It was just Discipleship. And it was retitled after Bonhoeffer's death and some of his popularity in Western Europe. But the German word is Nachfolge, which means following after. It's more of a verb. It's more of an action. Discipleship can be kind of a program. It was more of an action. I think of what we're called to today as this bold Nachfolge, right? Following after Jesus. When I try to inspire people with what I'm talking about, I point to Philippians 3, where Paul says, I had to lose all things. I had to suffer the loss of all things. What's interesting is he doesn't technically lose all things forever. He just reorients everything around Christ. So I think what I recommend to churches, and I know it's not practical advice, but I'm like, you got to take everything apart, every little piece. Like think of a massive Lego, structure. Take every single piece apart and say, how does this fit with Jesus? And then put it back. And if it can't be put back, you get rid of it.
Mm.
I think we often start with the world and we say, how can we move closer to Jesus? But we don't sometimes get very far. And what the early Christians did, they just took everything apart. The best early Christians, they took everything apart and they said, how do we put it together around Jesus? That's a harder way, but that way is going to keep Jesus at the center.
Yeah. Fabulous. Nijay, the book again, Strange Religion, How the First Christians Were Weird, Dangerous, Compelling, fabulous book. It was a joy to endorse. And it's a compelling, exciting, and interesting read that everybody owes themselves to pick up. And so thank you for writing it. Keep writing, brother, for the church. You're doing fabulous work. Everybody, thanks for listening to Slow Theology today. We got a really fun episode next. I'm really jazzed for what's coming in our next conversation. But for today, this has been Nijay. AJ, if this is helpful, give us a star or two. We take stars. We love a good star. Thanks for listening. Grace and peace, everybody.